Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the April issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. The next Native stars. In 2018, we profiled five young indigenous actors and performers making names for themselves in entertainment. Time to meet the impressive new crop of North American talent. By Wendy Wilkinson. DeFaro Wunatai. When we jumped on the phone with DeFaro Wunatai, the star of the hit FX series Reservation Dogs, was getting ready to fly to New York to attend New York Fashion Week and view the new Tom Ford collection. The 20-year-old actor's rising star might be tied to the hit show, but he already also has a reputation in the fashion world. Vogue recently called him Hollywood's stylish indigenous star to watch. Shot entirely in Oklahoma, Reservation Dogs is a dramedy created by Sterling Harjo and Taika Waititi. It revolves around a group of rebellious teenagers living in rural Oklahoma who hope to better their lives by moving to California. Wunatai, who is Oji Cree from Toronto, stands out in the lead role as Bear Smallhill, the de facto leader of the group. Played spectacularly by DeFaro, this series' breakout star, the Denver Gazette enthused, featuring all indigenous writers and directors and a majority of indigenous actors, the series also stars veteran Native actor Zahn McLaren, who is best known for his role on Longmire as tribal police officer Matthias. Before his breakout role in Reservation Dogs, the young Wunatai had just several guest star appearances under his belt, including such series as Tribal and Creeped Out, and the movie Beans about the Oka Crisis, a coming-of-age story portrayed against the backdrop of the 1990 land dispute and 78-day standoff, also known as the Mohawk Resistance, at Cane Stake between a group of Mohawk protesters. Quebec Police, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and the Canadian Army near the town of Oka outside of Montreal. An official selection of the 2020 Toronto International Film Festival, the film starred Wunatai as Hank opposite Mohawk actress and fellow rising star Kaiwan Teo. As a tribute to his rising star status, Wunatai was a presenter at the recent 73rd Primetime Emmy Awards. CNI. Tell us a bit about Bear Smallhill. It seems like he's the unofficial leader of the Reservation Dogs. Wunatai. I hear it a lot that I'm the unofficial leader of the group, and I understand why it's said. Both Bear and the character of Elora are very dynamic, but Daniel, the character who died a year before this story started, was truly our foundation and was probably responsible for the five of us getting to know each other. In Episode 7, it is revealed that Daniel committed suicide and Elora found his body. We have all lost someone, so this storyline is very relatable. Back to Bear. He has a good heart, but he knows that if he wants to go to California, he may have to do some minor illegal stuff to make this dream come true. CNI. Reservation Dogs is created almost entirely by indigenous talent, including producers, writers, and actors. This seems like a real breakthrough. Wunatai. It might be right now, but I think that several years from now, you're going to see many more indigenous writers, directors, and actors come to the front of the line. There were indigenous crew members on the set who had no television experience, but were given a chance. We all had shared experiences and traditions to draw from. CNI. How important is it that you study your native language, Ojibwe? Wunatai. My grandfather was a teacher of Indigenous language and studies at the University of Toronto, and he fought to keep those classes going and ultimately had to teach them in the hallway. Unfortunately, I didn't pay much attention to his teachings growing up, but I am now trying to work with the elders to learn both Ojibwe and Oji-Cree. Amber Midthunder. We first profiled Native American actress Amber Midthunder when she was starting to make her mark on both the big and little screen, playing Native and non-Native roles to good reviews. What a difference 4 years can make. Midthunder has been on a non-stop roll since then. From small roles in Hell or High Water and Longmire, the actor graduated to co-starring in the Marvel FX Legion series and the CW series Roswell, New Mexico, which is still going strong. In the past year, she has starred opposite Liam Neeson in The Ice Road. The big news is that she landed top billing as the lead in the latest installment of the widely popular sci-fi Predator franchise. Titled Prey, the big-budget prequel is predicted to be a blockbuster, and Midthunder as the female warrior Nehru, striving to protect her people from an alien threat 300 years in the past, likely to become a household name. "This is it for me. My calling and passion is acting," says Midthunder, whose father, actor David Midthunder, Longmire, is Nakota Dakota and Lakota Sioux, and mother Angelique is Asian and European. Filling out a very busy slate, Midthunder is also a youth ambassador at the Lompoc, California Wild Horse Conservation Organization, Return to Freedom. We caught up with Midthunder a week before she was returning to New Mexico to start filming Roswell, New Mexico again. CNI. Tell us a bit about growing up in Santa Fe. Midthunder. I had the opportunity to be a kid and grow up in an environment where I could ride horses and play with sticks. Even now, wherever I am and wherever I'm working, I try to leave the concrete and connect to the land. CNI. Congrats on your lead role in Prey, which is due out this summer. What was it like to play Nehru and drive the action as a powerful Indigenous woman? Midthunder. It was unbelievable. I feel extremely humbled. Working with director Dad Tachenberg was amazing. He's a great storyteller and so collaborative. Making this kind of movie with someone who is open and grounded and cares so much was incredible. Regardless of who played the role, the fact that this movie is the very first to have a female Indigenous protagonist in an action movie is huge. Carrying that responsibility was never lost to me, and I just hope to have done my people proud. CNI. The Ice Road was very male-centric. What was it like working with Liam Neeson? My experiences working with Liam were really good. I was the only young Indigenous or ethnic actor in the movie, and he was very supportive. Liam was very involved with the stunt work on the set, and as a responsible person, he made sure I was safe during this process. He used his position to help give me a space, and I felt that my voice was heard. But this is also obviously something that you work on to create for yourself. CNI. You recently produced a film called The Wheel. What was that experience like? Midthunder. The Wheel is an independent movie that a friend of mine wrote a couple of years ago, and I'm very excited about it. It's a very fun movie about a young couple who go to a B&B and learn a lot about each other. It's the type of story that makes me love acting. I read it not for me to act in, but felt jealous that an actor is really going to kill in the part. the COVID hit, and I had a lot of time on my hands, and a group of my friends teamed up, created a bubble at a summer camp, and shot the movie. CNI, lessons learned along the way. Mid-Thunder, I move around a lot and have learned how to take care of myself and feel at home wherever I am. I'm always very aware of how I represent myself, since what I do may influence the girls coming after me. Carson Gray. Award-winning singer-songwriter Carson Gray calls an archipelago just 50 miles off the coast of mainland British Columbia home. A peaceful place, virtually removed from the rest of the world, it's where Gray translates her Haida heritage and her natural surroundings into a unique, soulful sound infused with R&B energy and local spirit. Gray's mother recognized her daughter's talent early on after she recorded for the first time at the age of 9 in an amusement park amateur studio in Ontario. Her mom called Gray's uncle, Bobby Taylor, who fronted Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers, produced the Jackson 5's 1969 debut album, Diana Ross Presents the Jackson 5, and mentored other major talent. Gray's self-titled album debut earned the Best New Artist Award at SiriusXM's 2017 Indigenous Music Awards. Continuing her winning streak, Gray's 2018 collaboration on Wanna See You with Juno Award-nominated DJ Shub received Sirius's Best Radio Single. That year, she also performed at Juno Fest, an annual music celebration that includes artists of all genres from across Canada. CNI, talk to us about how Haida Gwaii and how the area being Haida have influenced your life and music. Carson, as a young girl, I traveled back and forth between Vancouver and Haida Gwaii, but moved back to the archipelago with my mom when I was 8. It is so beautiful here and is such a close-knit community. Haidas are known for their artwork and carvings, and I attended a school on the reserve where language and culture were part of our education. CNI. Then came the unexpected recording at the age of 9 and starting to work with Bobby Taylor. How did that come about? Gray. My mom and I went to Canada's Wonderland Amusement Park in Ontario, where you could go into one of those little booth-like music studios and record a song, hear your voice, and they would give the record to you. After listening to the record, my mom and I realized that I could really sing, and she said, "We need to get in touch with Uncle Bobby." We traveled to Vancouver to play the demo for him, and Uncle Bobby said, "I knew she had talent," and he invited me to perform in some local shows with him. He was my number one mentor and inspiration. CNI. What kind of a boost did winning Best New Artist in 2017 at Sirius's XM's Indigenous Music Awards give your career? I received a lot of notoriety during that time, and for the next 3 years I put out singles several times a year. It wasn't until the release of Sa Laana in 2020, where I showcased my community and the land I loved so much, that I garnered the attention of Network Music Group, and they signed me to their label. My husband, Joy Stylus, who is a music producer and rapper, gave me the push I needed to assemble my new 2022 EP. CNI. Speaking of the new EP, Each Moment, which came out in January, has several cuts, including Colors Like Yours, Someplace, and of course the title track, that seem like they might be particularly meaningful to you. Gray. I really wanted to create music by the surroundings I'm so inspired by, encouraging the listeners to put their phones down and take in the beauty of what you have in your life. Colors Like Yours is a reminder that everyone is a work of art, and the inspiration for some place was heaven, a not of this world place where we can find peace. Ashley Collingbull is a Cree model, actress, and television personality from the Enoch Cree Nation in Alberta, Canada. A professionally trained dancer, she started her acting career by starring in a commercial for the Hudson Bay. From 2011 to 2015, she starred in Blackstone, a political television drama set in a First Nations Canadian community. Most recently, she has appeared on Tribal and played herself on the Apple Plus streaming series The Morning Show. In 2015, Collingbull was honored as the first Canadian and Indigenous woman to win the Mrs. Universe title. But Collingbull is so much more than another pretty face. She and her stepfather participated in Season 4 of The Amazing Race Canada, and she was a recipient of the Top 20 Under 30 Award in Canada for her many accomplishments, including her volunteer work with Cree elders and youth and advocacy for her culture. Now 32, Collingbull continues to pursue her passion of making her community and world a better place as an international motivational speaker and role model for many educational institutions and workshops. CNI. What led up to your becoming the first Canadian and Indigenous woman to win the Mrs. Universe title in 2015? Collingbull. I actually started my pageant career in 2010, and the reason why I went this route is because I do a lot of charitable work and have used this visibility to raise funds for these organizations. Also, this visibility gave me a platform to raise awareness on the issues and needs of Native Americans. CNI. You unfortunately had anything but an idyllic childhood. How has that affected your life? Collingbull. It became a platform to discuss violence against women. This is something that affected me. I was abused from the age of 5 to 10. Having lived through poverty and abuse and moving forward after that was extremely difficult. I turned to my culture, and it literally saved my life and made me appreciate everything I have. Most important, it made me the strong woman I am today. I can now speak before an audience of 20,000 people. CNI. You and your dad competed in the fourth season of The Amazing Race Canada. What was that competition like? Collingbull. That was a show I'd always wanted to compete on, and my dad and I always had an idea about how we would do it. We were the first Indigenous team to ever appear on the show. Our journey took us from the Northwest Territories, where it was minus 50 degrees, all the way to Vietnam, where we ate local delicacies such as cockroaches and worms. We even made it to the finale. CNI, you've been honored over the years for being a motivational speaker and role model, including speaking at Harvard and a United Nations Global Dignity Day. Collingbull, this journey started at the hospital where my sister was being cared for and speaking with other victims and family members. It was a way for me to look forward and start another path, breaking barriers because I am Indigenous and a woman. This was my way of healing myself. I am now so much stronger. Keyshawn Whitehorse. Professional bull rider Keyshawn Whitehorse was born into the Navajo Nation on the Navajo Reservation in McCracken Spring, Utah. Bull riding wasn't a generational sport passed down to him as it is for most young cowboys. When he was 5 years old, Whitehorse woke up from a nap and noticed his father, Norbert, watching bull riding on TV and fell in love with the sport. Enthralled with what he saw on the screen, he told his dad he wanted to ride bulls. And the next day, father and son drove into town and outfitted Keyshawn as a cowboy. Now 24, Whitehorse won the 2018 Professional Bull Riding Rookie of the Year. He credits his family and heritage for helping him thrive under pressure. White Horse is currently pursuing a fifth consecutive PBR World Finals qualification. We caught up with him in McCracken Spring, Utah. C&I, how did you get into bull riding after first falling in love with the sport, watching it on television? White Horse, as a young boy, I never had a cowboy hat or cowboy boots, but woke one night, sat next to my dad, and started watching either Pro Rodeo or PBR on TV, and all of a sudden decided that riding bulls was what I wanted to do. The next day, my dad went into the little local Western store and bought me pint-sized spurs and a little calf rope. How did you progress from the five-year-old dreaming big to actually riding bulls? White Horse, as I got older, my family had horses here in McCracken Spring, and my uncle had some Black Angus cattle, and I would practice roping. My dad built me a bucking bull, and several years later, I went to a rodeo school in Colorado, where I learned how to ride bulls. My first rodeo event after attending school was in Colorado, and then I started to compete in local events in New Mexico and Arizona. C&I, in 2018, you won Rookie of the Year at the PBR World Finals. What was that like? Winning Rookie of the Year became a stepping stone for me to start achieving higher goals. That year was full of ups and downs, and I was trying to get a grasp on my talents and abilities. I've always been a hard worker and consistently trained very hard in 2018. What came next after that big win? I also had reached a high mental state during this time and achieved my lifelong goal of making it to a seated position on the PBR circuit and was able to go on tour. My family, faith, and friends really supported me during this time in my career, and I started to enjoy the benefits of all my hard work and began to look forward to my future and hopes to win a world's final. Then COVID slowed things down. But perhaps 2020 was the worst and the best thing that happened to me. I was able to put time into my rides and built an arena here, bought some bulls, and was practicing every week. What message would you like to send to Native American youth? White Horse, it's easy to get lost in this lifestyle. Being true to my roots and culture is who I am and how I was raised, and that keeps me grounded. I'm a huge believer in dreams and hopefully can serve as a role model, stressing to youth that they need to pursue their dreams as well. I'm thinking about creating a bull riding school here to share my knowledge and skills with young people on the reservation. Covering the West. C&I publisher Greg Brown reflects on some of his favorite cover stars during his tenure as owner and publisher. Sam Elliott and Robert Duvall. When I started doing covers, Sam was one of my first. He became a lifelong friend and is an icon in the Western world. I have tremendous respect for him and his wife, Catherine Ross. Of course, any time I've gotten to work with Robert Duvall on a shoot, it was fantastic. He loves Texas, especially Perini Ranch Steakhouse's barbecue. James Brolin. On our approach to shooting covers, you always want the person to feel comfortable. You want them to look engaged, looking at the camera. I think back to our great cover with James Brolin. Tom Selleck, another great guy, easy to be around, easy to talk to and ask questions. We visited about cowboy gear, tack, saddles, firearms. He's very knowledgeable and passionate about it all. Kevin Costner, he knows the look of a great Western shoot. He loves the lifestyle and he's a class act. An incredible storyteller. I've worked with him several times and look forward to working with him again in the future. Wes Studi. I've worked on two photo shoots with Wes Studi. He's so thoughtful. We got that amazing shot with him in front of that truck. It was at a friend's ranch in Las Vegas, New Mexico, one of my favorites. Kurt Russell, another great one. He appreciates and supports the Western lifestyle. A sincere guy who is passionate about the outdoors and the West. And Morgan Freeman. We shot Morgan at the Autry Museum in L.A., a legendary actor and professional. He was as interested in CNI as we were in him, which made for a fun day. Taylors and Company. Where legend meets performance. Taylors and Company honors tradition with high-end, historically accurate, single-action revolvers and lever-action rifles. By Lindsay Welchel. Outlaw, sheriff, cowboy or soldier, one likely common denominator among gunmen in the Old West was the quality of their weapons. Whatever the occupation, it's probably safe to say our forefathers knew a thing or two about guns, and their time-tested craftsmanship is still proving itself today. Taylors & Company honors that tradition and time-tested craftsmanship with its high-end, historically accurate reproductions of single-action revolvers and lever-action rifles. These iconic guns so precisely resemble the originals that they might as well be a time machine back to the 1800s. Let's say you were taking a Taylor's firearm with you as you traveled back in time. You'd have quite the advantage. The company's tagline, "Where legend meets performance," carries the implicit promise that its products deliver a piece of history with a modern touch. In its over 30 years in business, Taylors has been committed to preserving the allure of the Old West while taking customers into the New West with products that up the standard of manufacturing using today's technology and expertise. Founded in 1988 by Sue Hawkins McFarlane, Taylors & Company was built on the need for 100% accurate reproduction weapons. Their initial clientele? Civil War reenactors. The company has evolved and expanded to include a variety of firearms for every type of shooter. Taylors has multiple lines of product, explains Rob Girard, Vice President of Sales and Marketing. The Trailblazer series for customers new to the scene. The Lifestyle series for those who want to live the authentic cowboy lifestyle. The Performance Series for competition shooters, such as in the sport of cowboy mounted shooting. The Master Series for those who prize historical correctness. And the Black Powder Model Series for getting back to the historical firearm foundation that started Taylors. It's something for everybody, Girard says. I'm proud of the fact that we've helped a lot of people get into shooting, whether it's in any of these segments. And I'm proud of the fact that we're going to continue to grow the company in some traditional ways and some non-traditional ways. Perusing the company's yearly catalog offers a taste of the vast collection of special weaponry. The options are seemingly endless, from durable finishes to intricate tooling, a variety of smooth grips like walnut wood, and many different frames of guns with varied coloring, known as case hardening. In addition to the wide-ranging possibilities, there's also what the catalog calls a secret menu of limited collections and one-of-a-kind guns on offer. The top-notch quality Taylors is known for is achieved through a dedication to perfection that begins with sourcing their high-end products from Italy. Then the company improves upon the guns through a process they dub Taylor Tuning, with in-house gunsmiths who have 20 years of experience. It's much more than a matter of importing a gun from Italy and slapping their name on it, Girard explains. We're taking the time and care and effort to really make it a Taylor's gun. We do specific things to the guns that make them Taylor's. The guns get improved components, things like trigger pull strings that are basically lifetime adds to the gun. We rarely see something come back once we've touched it or modified it. Everything we do improves the performance of the gun. It improves the customer satisfaction, and it sets us apart from other importers. Given the caliber of shooters using the old-fashioned firearm, the resulting performance of the gun is critical, even for the most tactical of them. The shooters of the past didn't have a magazine of 17 shots to get it done, and it was a revolver, which is a completely different style of shooting than the automatic. If you can shoot well the old-fashioned way, then you can definitely do it with newer technology. In a lot of ways, it takes more skill, and it's a different way of shooting than just holding a semi-automatic pistol. Catering to customers who meticulously adhere to this type of pastime demands a new level of customer service, too. We go above and beyond to service our customers. We go out of our way to make sure they are happy. It's one of the things that got Taylor's to where it is today, Gerard says. And in rare instances, when there might be a manufacturer's error, the company is committed to doing whatever it can to make it right. When it comes to the quality of products and customer satisfaction, Taylor's plans to keep upping the ante and aiming for the bullseye. The company is teasing some exciting new product launches that will continue to set the company apart. We're definitely a find-a-way type of company, Gerard says. I think you get out what you put in, and we put a lot of hard work into it. For more information and to view firearms, visit taylorfirearms.com. 90 years of Loretta Lynn. Country stars join us in singing the praises of one of the most influential artists and songwriters of all time in her 90th birthday year. By Allison Bonagura. Loretta Lynn is one country artist that everybody knows. You might have followed her story career since her 1960 debut hit, I'm a Honky Tonk Gal. Maybe you learned all about her life growing up in Butcher Hollow, Kentucky, through the autobiography Coal Miner's Daughter, or the classic biopic film adapted from it. You might have taken notice of her musical collaborations with everyone from the late Conway Twitty to the White Stripes frontman Jack White. No matter how you know her, and chances are you love her. After selling more than 45 million albums and maintaining her status as the most awarded female country artist, Lynn still seems as affable and approachable as she was when she was just getting her start in the music business. The legend reaches her milestone 90th birthday on April 14th, more than 80 years after she heard a tune on a radio for the first time at age 11, Ernest Tubbs' Walking the Floor Over You, to be exact. While the song and the experience made an immediate impact, Lynn has admitted in the past that making music for herself was never her idea. On her 18th birthday, her husband, Oliver Doolittle Lynn, bought her a $17 Harmony guitar from Sears. A few years later, he told her she had a good voice. After a while, I got to where I could play a pretty good tune on it. First, I was singing Kitty Wells songs on it. But after a while, I started making up my own, she recalls in the pages of Coal Miner's Daughter. Anything I go at hard, because I only do what I want. By the time Lynn was 28, it was time for her to take the stage and start playing her own songs for an audience of more than just her husband and children. In 1960, when the Lynns were living in Custer, Washington, they went to Delta Grange Hall in Linden to hear country music. She was eventually offered $5 to play there. When they asked her for a repeat performance and paid her another $5, Lynn said, I thought I was a millionaire. Now, 62 years later, she likely still experiences the intense gratitude for the legendary career she's put together, even though she's never been one to flaunt her fortune. Her late manager, David Skepner, once said, "Loretta has no idea what she's worth. All she knows is that she has a good time every day, and she gets well paid for it." For Lynn, all these years in the country music business weren't just about making a living. She was trailblazing, whether she intended to or not. In 1962, she was inducted into the Grand Ole Opry just a few years after the first female solo artists, Gene Shepherd, Kitty Wells, Margie Bowes, and Patsy Cline, were. Then, a decade later, when she was nominated for the Country Music Association's Entertainer of the Year Award in 1972, the nomination alone was history-making. "I didn't care if I won it. I was just proud to be the first woman ever nominated. I think it's good for people to realize that women can do things as good as a man," Lynn said. She did win the top prize that year and has continued to stockpile trophies ever since. She's won plenty more CMA Awards, Academy of Country Music Awards, Grammy Awards, American Music Awards, and even the ACM Honors Poets Award in 2021, a lesser-known but still prestigious honor that goes to the artists with long-standing lyrical contributions to country music. As Lynn herself has said, "You can't be halfway in this business," and she never has. Part of what has continued to set her apart is her longevity in country music, and part of that comes from how she sees the music, how she's always seen it. Real country music is pure, it's simple, it's real. When a song ain't real, how's it supposed to get anybody through anything? Country music will always take you back, the proud Country Music Hall of Famer says, and it'll always feel like home, no matter what. Here are some country stars talking about Loretta Lynn. "As artists, we all stand on the shoulders of the incredible artists that have come before us, but I think that is especially true for females in country music. Strong, talented, smart, sassy women like Loretta Lynn are responsible for any of us having the opportunities in this business we have today. I think we all sang into our hairbrushes trying to emulate the vocal styles of artists like Loretta. Getting to sing Still Woman Enough with her and Reba was a moment I will never forget. Music is in Loretta's soul. Her legacy will outlive us all, which is so beautiful." Carrie Underwood. For some people, country music is what they do. For Loretta, country music is who she is. "When I was a kid on the farm in Kansas, I remember hearing One's on the Way, and I thought it was so cool because it's about Topeka. Nobody else could sing those kinds of songs. They're so her. I was drawn to her authenticity and how her voice is so honest. It sounds like she's having a conversation with you. I wanted to do music like that too, and she's not going anywhere. When I see her, she'll be like, 'We need to do a tour together, me and you. We'd tear it up.'" Martina McBride. "When I was a kid, I used to sing Your Squaw Is on the Warpath, This City, Sweet Thing, and more. Loretta Lynn was a big influence for me. She is part of me. When I was out there singing in bars trying to get started, I sang all her songs, every one of them. Blue Kentucky Girl was one of my favorites, and I still do that in my shows. I started out copying her and ended up sounding like me. There's nothing false about Loretta." Tanya Tucker. "I sang a lot of her songs when I started as an artist. People always wanted to hear songs like Coal Miner's Daughter because I was so country. She is a part of everything for a chick country singer. I've always appreciated being able to hear such an iconic country singer who never tried to be cool or pop. She just was cool. And Loretta was just being Loretta. You hear other singers, myself included, and sometimes it sounds like they're a little lost, like they don't know vocally where they are. But Loretta never went through that because from the very first song she recorded to the most recent one, she sounds exactly the same. When she opens her mouth, Loretta comes out. Leanne Womack. When I was a girl, I heard Coal Miner Daughter and would sing it to the top of my lungs. Before there was karaoke, you could buy LPs that were basically tracks to sing along with your favorite songs. I was a little impersonator and was definitely influenced by Loretta's sound. I tried to imitate her style and voice. Loretta came from extreme poverty. Her job saved her life and her family. I think she's never forgotten where she came from, and I think that's part of why she works so hard. She's respected and revered for being a pioneer in singing and songwriting in a time when women definitely did not get the same chances as men in that field. Loretta has already made history, but her work ethic keeps her going. She paved the way for every female artist that followed. I'm here because she was there. Trisha Yearwood. My earliest memory of Loretta was when I sat down with her album Blue Kentucky Girl when I was 12, and I learned to play Blue Kentucky Girl on the guitar. We all grew up loving her and all had our different versions of why we related to her. It was very natural. That's why I can write stories out of my life. She never tried to write within a margin or write songs within a fence. I'm sure she was scrutinized at time for her lyrics. What that taught me is that you can be real and raw and unapologetically yourself. And there's something about the Appalachian music. If you grow up in Kentucky, you understand the richness of what that area brought to country and bluegrass music. You can hear some of that sorrowful singing in her music and the tear in her voice. When I'm 90, even if nobody's listening, I'm going to continue to do it because it's who I am. Carly Pierce. Loretta was just dealing with life with her guitar before she even started making music. Her sense of humor, her sense of strength, and the fact that she said things so bluntly stood out to me. She would never cut down the man as much as she had addressed the issue in the other person, and she'd do it in such an honest and personal way. Speaking your truth like that is something we both share, and what she was doing was so risque for the times. She was singing about the pill in that era when you never really even said the word pregnant. Those were private things, but she said them. She was so groundbreaking and set the bar for a lot of females. And even now, she still shows up in her sequins, ready to go, and walks up to the microphone ready to sing her songs and tell her stories so authentically. That is so inspiring, and I'm grateful that we have an artist like Loretta who never tried to be something she's not. Deanna Carter.
Hello, this is Michael reading an article from True West Magazine, April 2022 edition. A Continuous Picnic Goes South by Bob Bozbell. Like so many bad trips, this one started out as a fun adventure. The so-called Brewster Wagon Train departed Independence, Missouri on August 10, 1850. 93 religious pioneers seeking a life in the land of Bashan headed west in 43 wagons, loaded down with 8 months' worth of provisions. It was a continuous picnic, and excitement was plentiful, is how Susan Thompson described the journey she took at the age of 17. She described the food prepared, the stores of jerked meat, dried apples and berries, flour, corned beef, meal, preserved fruits, bacon and beans that we had prepared during the spring months. The wagon stopped every two or three days, she added. While the women baked and washed, the men hunted for antelopes or buffaloes or smaller game. Often, when we were camping near a stream, we had quantities of fresh fish. In the evenings, we gathered about the campfires and played games or told stories or danced. The young folks danced in the light of the campfire and lard-burning lanterns. There was plenty of frolic, and where there are young people gathered together, there is always plenty of lovemaking. Of course, the good times didn't last. Petty infighting, alternative visions, and illnesses took their toll. So much so that by the time the wagon train reached Socorro, New Mexico territory, the ranks had been cut in half. Once those dwindling number of immigrants reached Maricopa Wells, south of present-day Phoenix, Arizona, the wagons had been reduced to three. A month later, one wagon would push on toward the Colorado River, where the Edenesque land of Bashan allegedly waited, at the confluence of the Gila and Colorado rivers. That wagon, piloted by Royce, also styled as Royce, Oatman. From Maricopa Wells, the Oatman family took off alone. They had traveled 1,800-some miles and were 120 miles from their goal. West of the Great Gila Bend, the Oatman wagon bogged down and had trouble crossing the river. Halfway across, the oxen gave out. All the coaxing and pulling didn't work. As nightfall set in, the family was able to push the wagon up on a sandbar to try and wait out the surging water so they could continue their journey. The water kept rising into the night and even snuffed out the family's meager fire. The kids huddled together under their wagon, and one heard their father say, "Mother, mother, in the name of God, I know that something dreadful is about to happen." If Royce actually said this, the comment was attributed to him after the events that followed. No truer words have ever been spoken. The Oatman Massacre, February 18, 1851. Royce Oatman and his family have just finished hauling their belongings up a rocky grade to a bluff on the south side of the Gila River. At the end of this long day, the Oatman oxmen are bone tired, and so is the family. Roy's 38-year-old wife, Mary Ann, is 8.5 months pregnant, and she has just enough strength to prepare a pot of bean soup and some bread for the family to eat before they continue on. The family intends to travel all night to avoid the heat of the day. They are 120 miles from their destination. The oldest boy, Lorenzo, 14, is loading up the last of the baggage in the wagon. When he turns and sees several Indians slowly and leisurely approaching us in the road. Lorenzo later says they converse with father in Spanish and made the most vehement profession of friendship. Royce is not armed. He has a rifle, but it is in the wagon. The Indians, thought to be Yavapais, ask for tobacco and pipe, which Royce promptly produces. After the warriors finish smoking, one of them mentions seeing two horses down in the brush. An American traveler later reports that his two horses had been stolen the day before. The Yavapais ask for pinole, cornmeal. Royce protests that he doesn't have enough to give away, but they persist, and he reluctantly gives them some bread, which they eat. Then they ask for more. When Royce tells them that he doesn't have any more, a Yavapa brazenly walks over to the wagon and climbs in the back, rummaging around inside. When he comes out, he demands meat. The emboldened Yavapas start taking objects from the wagon and stuffing items in their clothing. When the family protests, the Yavapas withdraw a few paces and begin talking in their native tongue. Essentially, they are divvying up who to kill and who to spare. Royce tries to keep calm and starts reloading the wagon. At this point, a Yavapaz lets out a deafening yell, and each warrior attacks a member of the family with a war club. Royce, his wife, his daughters Lucy, 16, and Charity Ann, 3, and sons Royce Jr., 5, and Roland, too, are brained senseless, falling to the ground. Lorenzo is also bashed on the head. With blood streaming down his face, he half runs, half stumbles toward the edge of the bluff and falls over the side. Only two are spared, Olive, 13, and Marianne, 8, who are forced to watch the warriors strip their family's dead bodies looking for items of value. They take the wheels off the wagon and tear the canvas canopy off its frame. While breaking open boxes, the raiders also tear a feather bed, scattering its feathers to the wind. The Yavapais unhook the oxen, bundle up their plunder, and rudely push the girls in front of them. They take the sisters' bonnets and shoes and force the girls to walk barefoot toward the Yavapai camp some 90 miles away. Olive describes what happens next. After we had descended the hill and crossed the river and traveled about one half of a mile by a dim trail leading through a dark, rough, and narrow defile in the hills, we came to an open place where there had been an Indian camp before and halted. The Indians took off their packs, struck a fire, and began in their own way to make preparations for a meal. They boiled some of the beans just from our wagon, mixed some flour with water, and baked it in the ashes. They offered us some food, but in the most insulting and taunting manner, continually making merry over every indication of grief in us, and with which our hearts were ready to break. We could not eat. After the meal and about an hour's rest, they began to repack and make preparations to proceed. Olive Oatman describing the first grief-stricken moments of her five-year ordeal. For almost a century, historians thought the raiders were Tonto Apaches and that they took the Oatman girls into the Tonto Basin area. Historians now believe the raiders were Yavapais and that they took the sisters to a mountain camp in the Harquahala Mountains, since the Apaches did not traditionally trade with the Mojaves, where the girls ended up. The Indians were probably Yavapais, argues Brian McGinty of The Oatman Massacre. True West, April 2022. Ask the Marshal. Breckenridge, Breweries, and Rattlesnakes by Marshall Trimble. Question. I was reading some stories about Tombstone. Some historians have speculated that Billy Breckenridge may have been gay. Is that true? Paul Gutierrez, Phoenix, Arizona. Wells Fargo agent Fred Dodge may have started rumors by saying, Billy was a nice young girl in those days, and undoubtedly today is a nice old lady. But just what Dodge meant by that is unknown. He certainly didn't come out and say that Breckenridge was gay. That was picked up by people including Sadie Marcus Earp, Wyatt's common-law wife, and author-fabricator Glenn Boyer. They were trying to smear Breckenridge, but offered nothing to back it up. Breckenridge was fearless and a pretty good lawman. His abilities with a firearm and his fists were well known. He just happened to be with the anti-Earp faction during the feud in Cochise County. It's true that he never married, but there's no proof that Breckenridge was gay. Question. Were there brewers in the Old West? Mark Collins, Fostoria, Ohio. Yes, several German immigrants opened breweries. Adolphus Busch started Budweiser in 1876 in St. Louis. Adolf Coors was founded in the West in 1873 in Golden City, Colorado. Several other companies later branched out in the West. Question. Can you tell me about the Yuma Crossing and the native people who lived there? Udo Zindel, Stuttgart, Germany. The Yuma, Kishin, Quatsin lived at the junction of the Colorado and Gila Rivers. They claimed a vast amount of land on the lower Colorado. When the U.S. gained possession following the Mexican War, the crossing was vitally important, as it was the only all-weather route to California. So a military post, Fort Yuma, was built there. Following the gold rush to California in 1849, many of the immigrants passing through abused the Quechan people and let their livestock feed on their native crops. They were a fierce warrior tribe, and for a time they rebelled, forcing the soldiers to abandon the fort. Still, the tribe was forced onto the reservation in 1884. Question: how do lawmakers make sure that there are no rattlesnakes while they are filming Westerns? Kenny Endemann, Oneida, New York. Then and now, they had to deal with them. Most of those actors in the early days were real cowboys, so they were used to being wary of rattlers. A rattlesnake doesn't usually go looking for trouble, so as long as you don't startle it, they would get out of the way. Question: what were tumbleweed wagons? Jim Bogle, Columbia, South Carolina. Tumbleweed wagons, or jails on wheels, varied from place to place. About the only thing they had in common is they all had bars on the windows and door. The prisoners were usually being transported to a courthouse to be tried. For example, when Deputy U.S. Marshal Bass Reeves went out in the Indian Territory with a handful of warrants, he took along a tumbleweed wagon and a cook. At night, they camped, and the cook prepared the grub. The prisoners slept on the ground, chained up to the rear axle of the wagon. After chow the next morning, they got back into the wagon. The trip to the federal court in Fort Smith might have taken several days. Question: when did the last wagon travel on the Oregon Trail? Sharon Watson, Portland, Oregon. The last wagon known to have traveled the length of the trail was driven in 1906 by Ezra Meeker. He was an aging Oregon Trail immigrant who was conducting a one-man publicity campaign to remind people of the historic significance of the Oregon Trail. However, we've had visitors at the end of the Oregon Trail Interpretive Center who recalled that because their family couldn't afford the train fare, they traveled the trail by wagon as late as 1912.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.